This is Mishmash, a weekly conversation where we try to unjumble an important and sometimes under-the-radar statewide story that affects you. I'm Shayna Raw.
And I'm Alethea Kasman. Teachers and educators upped the ante this week in their opposition to a budget proposal that would move $670 million from retirement healthcare contributions toward other areas in the education budget, telling lawmakers to pause any conversation on a $6 billion 10-year economic development plan until after this is settled. These groups said they are agnostic on the economic development policy, but want to see the state continue to pay the retirement healthcare costs so schools and teachers can pay less. Peter Spadafore, executive director of the Michigan Alliance for Student Opportunity, addressed the educators' proposal during a press conference this week.
And we're asking folks to pause on spending that money until we settle this question. So I can understand the sort of the philosophical disagreement on how this works, but until those funds are completely separated, every dollar that's spent everywhere has an impact on the possibility of revenue and resources available for the classroom.
Governor Whitmer's team and supporters say the division wouldn't hurt the school aid fund at all. Spokeswoman Stacey LaRouche told Gongwer that they would be, quote, reinvesting the additional $670 million in supporting children's education and boosting teacher paychecks, which remains one of our top priorities. LaRouche also said education groups are trying to force a, quote, false choice between education funding and economic development, and that the state can actually do both.
But the teachers are not convinced. First, these education groups note the budget is all intermingled. So while the $670 million might be used in the school aid fund, they argue it is still helpful for the general fund that is used for things outside of education. Second, these groups say the reason the retirement fund is set to be funded at 100%, which is what allows the diversion in the first place, is because of sacrifices teachers have made. By the state continuing to pay the full $670 million, schools claim they can pay less from their paychecks and put more money into the classroom.
For me, what's really interesting here is seeing the political implications. We've got school groups who are so outspoken against a Democratic plan, which doesn't happen very often. They've long been Democratic supporters, and Democrats have noted this and seem to be making some attempts to assuage their concerns. House Appropriations Committee Chair Rep. Angela Whitworth told reporters recently that lawmakers will always work with our teachers. And given that Democrats are staring down what could be a very tight election and want to keep their majority in the House, this feels like a group they really can't afford to lose right now.
Definitely. These groups are major allies of the Democrats and the governor. And these education groups sent some shockwaves through the Capitol this week when they tied this issue to the economic development plan Whitmer wants to see on her desk. They basically told lawmakers, we will oppose this proposal if you don't deal with the retirement issue in a way we can be on board with. That has huge implications for a plan Democrats already have to work hard to pass.
Outside of disagreement among friends, Republicans also don't like this retirement proposal and have been rallying against it all year. This is especially problematic for the Democrats in the Senate, where they need Republicans to give the budget immediate effect. The Senate GOP has indicated they may not provide those required votes if the retirement plan is in the final budget.
And the budget absolutely needs immediate effect because it starts October 1st, not next year. So these are real issues for Democrats to overcome before July 1st, the deadline for lawmakers to pass the budget, and when they are scheduled to start their summer recess. So 2 weeks to go and a lot of ground to cover.
Well, we're going to take a short break here, but when we come back, we're going to be joined by Democratic State Representative John Fitzgerald to talk about quite a few things, including short-term rentals and a proposal to tax those. You're not going to want to miss it. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Mishmash. I'm Shayna Roth.
And I'm Alethea Kasman. We're joined now by Democratic State Rep. John Fitzgerald. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start today with short-term rentals. It is almost summer after all. So to get this started, you know, what kind of challenges do these short-term rentals, Airbnb, VRBO, what do these pose right now?
Well, you're right. It's summer season, which really means it's short-term rental season here in the state of Michigan. We know that so many travelers now are really debating whether or not they stay in a traditional lodging facility or they take an STR and they go with the family and really find a facility that fits their specific needs or the specific vacation that they're envisioning. But across the state of Michigan, whether it be in Southwest Michigan or even in the Thumb, the UP, we're seeing that short-term rentals are becoming a real topic of concern and interest for local governments across the state. Recognizing that housing stock is finite. You know, we cannot create more houses overnight by, you know, the wave of a wand. We can't create more housing units for year-round residents without there also being competition for that, potentially in the investment space. That's what's really sparked this conversation. I think that Representative Andrews from the 38th District really brought this forward with consultation from his local governments that you see along the lakeshore in very close proximity to Indiana and specifically Chicago. We also see that in areas like Traverse City that have seen a real attraction to Midwest travelers from across the region, that there is also now an influx in people saying, gosh, I really wish my second home were here. And so these short-term rental units are not only seen as investments, but also seen as potential second homes or, quite frankly, new year-round residents. Retirees or those who can work remotely are now looking for a better view out of their home office. And of course, we know that Michigan is a beautiful place to be. It's a beautiful place to reside. And that's what I think has really inspired some of this conversation around the bill is what is it that we can do to support local governments, support attraction of people to Michigan, and balance that with individual property rights and the needs of an individual community.
So there's clearly, as you've mentioned, benefits to having short-term rentals. And I would also add that if you're a parent, being able to have an extra room away from your children is also a great benefit of a short-term rental because a lot of these tend to be, you know, apartments or actual homes. But you have legislation out that would add an additional tax onto short-term rentals. What are some of the key points of the legislation that you're sponsoring?
It's not legislation that I've sponsored. It's been sponsored by Representative Andrews, but it is in my committee, which I chair local.
Yes, in your committee.
I chair local government and municipal finance. I'm sorry, my lights just turned off. If you give me a second here. But my committee is actually the one that's hearing this. And I think that at the end, what we really want to look at is an opportunity to say, what is it that local communities need to do their jobs well? Traditional lodging facilities are expensive to build. They're expensive to maintain. And so when you go onto any national website right now and you say, I want to spend a weekend in Lansing, Michigan, you're going to get hotels as well as short-term rental options presented to you. And that is really, I think, a change in the direction of lodging across the country. I think that you're exactly right. When you look at what is it that the individual is seeking in their vacationing experience? I'm a young family. We have a young daughter, and we've done the adjoining suite, the adjoining rooms, because when your child goes to bed at 7:30, I think many parents have the experience of sitting there in the bathroom with the light on so that the baby can sleep with the lights off. And that's
or hiding under the covers.
Or hiding under the covers and hiding that screen, right? You don't want to light up the room. And so I think the point is short-term rentals are now emerging as a true traditional lodging option. And because of that, we do see the potential loss in revenue for places like conventions and visitors bureaus. And so what we're trying to create here, I think, within the bill is some sort of parity to say traditional lodging facilities pay these additional fees and taxes that support local community tourism, support community events. Why shouldn't short-term rentals, which I think are now past the proof point. We know that they are going to exist. Why shouldn't those also be contributing to these same taxes that traditional lodging facilities do as well?
You know, there have been a few tries at fixing this issue over the last couple of years, and it's been tough to get sort of the sides together on this. So local governments, they support these bills. They would also, allow for more sort of regulation and registering of these properties. But groups like the Realtors, Restaurant and Lodging Association, Airbnb, they're all opposed. So how, do you respond to the opposition and what are sort of the sticking points here?
Let me say this, trust the process. good process can really develop good policy. You know, when we chose to bring this forward in committee, when I, as the chair, chose to bring this forward and enter it into really the public square of conversation, it was to inspire, I think, greater transparency around the hesitations and the needs of various groups. That is really where you see the Restaurant and Lodging Association, the realtors, the Convention and Visitors Bureaus step out and say, this is what we need to make this more appealing to our membership and more functional for our mission as a group. I think that there is, again, that balance that is being seen is, you know, if you as an individual property owner cannot rent that, are we infringing on individual property rights? If we have this excise tax and it's going towards, you know, local governments only, are we not also leaving potentially the Convention and Visitors Bureaus out of the process where they have been traditionally been reliant for their funding through those excise taxes? And so it's really a balancing of a 8-way scale where we're trying to bring people out of opposition and crafting a solution through conversation, open dialogue, and I think that that's really the process that's been driven since we heard this in committee. We've seen work groups, we've seen individual membership groups come together for conversations, and I think really some good negotiation. That's the process that we wanted to inspire. I think we've been successful in that, and I do think that we will have some draft substitutes to bring forward here in the short term that will potentially appease a number of these groups and I think really support the industry here as a whole in Michigan.
Is there a chance that these bills are going to move before the summer recess starts, which is actually coming up very quickly in the next few weeks?
You know, I will say that there's a chance, but I wouldn't say that it's an overwhelming chance. There are some calendar issues that we have in place. You know, our focus as the House Democratic Caucus is to get this budget done and across the finish line. So there are going to be potentially just calendar issues with getting this done. We also have a new state holiday in the middle of the month with Juneteenth, which also falls on a regular committee day for local government. And so with the observation of that holiday, the calendar, the session calendar for budget, it is going to be tight. But I think that even still, the work is going to be done in the background to move this forward and to, I would say, at its first opportunity that we have an agreement, bring that forward for a committee vote.
Another bill, or a bill that you have actually sponsored, is that's sitting on the House floor right now, would allow cameras to detect those speeding through school zones and allow for tickets for violations to be issued that way. You know, why do you think that this is important?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about my history with cameras. I initially was not on board when we voted to install fixed license plate readers in my city, city of Wyoming. I was on the city council, and they brought forward this proposal to have fixed license plate readers that just takes a picture of the license plate, the make and model of the car. And I thought, my gosh, this just seems really Big Brother-ish, right? This seems like law-abiding citizens are going to have their information captured, and how is that stored, and when is it destroyed, and where does that go? But over time, I realized, gosh, this is really helping us solve cases. You know, we understand that if there's a stolen vehicle, it's now passing through major intersections, and we know that it went into Kentwood, our neighboring city. And so we can work with interdepartmental supports to solve crimes. And so I actually voted the second time through to expand that program in the city of Wyoming. And when it comes to speed cameras, that's something that we don't have here in the state of Michigan. We do have it in neighboring states or other Midwest states like Illinois and others. And I've traveled through those states and not felt exceptionally burdened by that. But I think that there has to be a reason to that. It shouldn't just be to generate revenue, or it shouldn't just be to push back on individual driving habits. Rather, it should be with an end goal in mind. And we've seen two speed zone bills, camera speed zone enforcement bills come forward, one for work zones and one for school zones. And I think that in both of those cases, they're looking at vulnerable roadway users and how do we improve safety for not only the motorist, but also those who they're sharing the roadway with. Pedestrians going to school, workers who are working to improve Michigan's infrastructure. And I think that that is a worthy goal to ensure that our children are getting to school safely and are not going to be potentially put into peril due to driver habits.
So, Representative, this package has been around for a little while now. What are the concerns keeping it from moving? And are you still pushing for this potentially before summer? And I would think ideally before school starts up again in the fall.
Yeah, I will continue to advocate for the passage of this bill. You know, I think it really is worthy of a floor vote. So I will continue to push that forward. I understand, though, that this is not going to be leapfrogging, you know, major priorities like the budget in terms of importance. And so I think that there is an awareness to the need for this. I represent a district where I have 8 school districts in a relatively small geographic district. And that means I have neighborhood school districts. So many school districts where children are walking to school. They're riding their bike to school. And especially when you get into January and February, when it is still dark, when those children are arriving at school at 7:30, 8 a.m., and they're crossing major roadways, we want to have safety prioritized as soon as we can. And so, yes, I will be advocating for this to be, you know, moved as quickly as possible. But still, you know, I think that this is, you know, something where we need to continue to take in stakeholder feedback. There's been some interest in where do the fine, the dollars collected from the fines go? Are those supporting community initiatives like libraries? Are those going to be going back to the police departments themselves? You know, we may still have some movement in the language to see how that is distributed based on the fines. But again, we're talking about a $100 to $150 fine. It's not large fines like $250 or $500, but it is enough to change driver habits, right? You have to be going more than 10 miles an hour over the speed limit as part of the bill to be cited. And that means that in a 25 mile an hour school zone, you're going 35 or greater. And so that is a pretty high rate of speed when we know that at 25 miles an hour, the reaction time and your awareness to your surroundings is greater than at 35, 45 miles an hour. I would say the same thing. You know, if this is something where a school is on a 45 mile an hour road, the school zone goes down to 25 or 35, you have to be traveling at a relatively high rate of speed and in some cases, willfully ignoring the flashing school zone signs. And so this is really something to say, there is a camera here, there is a fine associated with this up to $150, and speed cameras are being used to track this. That, I think, will really inspire different driver habits, not only in urban districts, but rural districts as well, where schools are on, you know, state highways at 55 miles an hour. I think that this has a real great chance to impact communities up and down the state of Michigan.
So let's move on to discussing the elections this year. I don't know if you know, but it is an election year. Before you know, we get to before we get to questions on your reelection campaign, you know, you come from a family with a long line of public servants. Can you tell us a little bit about your family's history in state government? And I'm curious if because of it, you always knew you wanted to run for office.
Yeah. So, I met another legacy legislator who said, you know, they were version 2.0 or 3.0. And so, you know, I'm Fitzgerald 5.0 in this city. It actually goes all the way back to the 1894 election. And my great-great-grandfather was a one-term state representative from Eaton County. And that's where all of my generations of public servants came from, Eaton County. And I had my great-grandfather who was Secretary of State and governor. Unfortunately, his claim to fame is that he is the only Michigan governor to die while serving as governor. And so that was 1939. But his son, my grandfather, went on to be a senator and chief justice of the Supreme Court. And his son, my father, was a 12-year state representative, most notably serving as Speaker Pro Tem for 4 years during split power in the early 90s. And so I was young. I was actually born in an election year, 1990. And growing up, I saw my dad do really impressive things when it came to public policy. He championed the seatbelt legislation, the primary enforcement of seatbelts, for years. And to see him put so much passion into that, not for, you know, his gain or for only his community's benefit, but for truly state benefit, was really something that stuck with me. And I think that that really along with the example of my grandparents, my mother, my dad, really showed me what it meant to be a selfless, engaged community member and public servant. And so I think that it always kind of stirred in me that this may be a pathway that I would like to seek. But after I got out of college and my wife and I moved to West Michigan, we've been in West Michigan now for 10 years, it was, let's be just good stewards of our community. And that really culminated to my run for city council in Wyoming. Successfully ran for that in 2020 in the midst of COVID, the early days of COVID, which was an incredibly challenging campaign. Seeing as I knocked thousands of doors with a mask on outside because we weren't aware of what was causing the spread for a good deal of that campaign season. That this was something where I was able to get into public service, realize that this is something that really did fulfill me. It really gave me joy to see other people be supported or to create programs that were improving our community as a whole. And that's what really called me to then jump to the next level, realizing that there was a lot of work that I wanted to do in state policy. And so that's a little bit of the history, why I'm doing this, and I think why I want to really exemplifies why I want to continue doing this as well.
Now, your seat is a top target for Republicans this year, and they've recruited a former representative well known in the area to run against you, Tommy Brand. What is your message to voters?
My message to voters is, over the last year and a half, I think that you can say without uncertainty that this has been some of the most engaged and community-oriented leadership that our community has ever seen. I don't know that the city of Wyoming has ever received a direct appropriation. And last year they received funds to really create transformational infrastructure in the city. My leadership is one that is community driven as well. You know, we have 2 ears and one mouth. And so I remained committed to being engaged and available to my constituency, holding office hours twice a month, coffee hours once a month. We did Small Business of the Month awards. We did Educator of the Month awards. And we were in the community day in and day out. And that was something where I don't know that we've seen that before. This is a full-time legislature. This is my full-time job. And this is something where I am truly committed to putting Wyoming on the trajectory that I think it knows it has, which is on the up and up. As the largest suburb to Grand Rapids, people don't know about Wyoming, Michigan. It's a city that is actually almost the size of Flint, and yet we are unknown to the outside world from Metro Grand Rapids. And I think that that is something that's really going to change because of a lot of the policy that we've created, but also the leadership that I've been able to deliver here in Lansing and promoting the community well-being for families, children, and seniors across the board. That's my message.
You know, this election, you know, is high stakes for Democrats who want to keep control of the Michigan House and keep the Democratic trifecta in place. Your seat, you know, is a must win if Dems want to keep House control. You know, how are you feeling right now? How confident are you that Democrats can keep the House for next year?
I feel very confident that the work that we have done over 18 months is going to resonate with Michigan voters. We've cut taxes. We've provided greater services to children and families for healthcare. We've helped seniors get more resources than ever before. And we've invested in critical infrastructure needs across the state. I understand that times feel tough. And we have a media environment where we can't really turn it off. Whether we go onto Facebook to look for what our cousin is up to, or you know what your sister's doing three states away, the fact is you're going to be inundated with news, and so it's really hard to turn that off and allow for space to really kind of, if you will, touch grass and realize that things are still pretty good. The sun is rising. We know that people in my community go to work every day, and it's hard. They're working jobs that are barely meeting the median household income for the state. And so that work that we have done is great. And we have a vision for even more work that we can do to support working families in Michigan. And that, I think, is a message that will resonate across Michigan. It's not what we're against, it's what we're for. And it's for the improvement and the holistic wellness of people across the state.
How do you think things are going at the top of the ticket? You know, President Joe Biden is leading the Democrats. I know there's still a bit of time before November, but do you think Democrats will see the enthusiasm and turnout with the current Joe Biden that they experienced the last few cycles?
It's such a great question because, you know, the way it was framed at the start there was, how do I feel about the top of the ticket? Well, one is convicted and one is not. And so I think that that's, you know, a pretty indicative to not only how I feel, but I think how millions and millions of Americans feel as well. We are not comfortable with how our current political climate looks. I don't think that Americans overall are really enthusiastic about our political landscape right now. But at the end of the day, are we ready to vote for democracy and decency and courtesy and putting people at the center of policy? Or are we willing to vote for an autocratic dictatorship that has said that there are going to be consequences for people's actions in 2020? That is a knife's edge that we are walking if people are saying, gosh, I don't know if I know enough about these two candidates. And I'll tell you, I think that President Joe Biden and former President Trump are the names on the ballot. But when we look at the department heads who have made an impact in their various spaces and their various departments across the country, I think that we really do have an administration that is putting America's future on the right track, top to bottom, in Washington, D.C. And so I will be casting my vote for Joe Biden in November, and I really look forward to preserving democracy in that country, in this country, with that vote.
All right, Representative Fitzgerald, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's it for us this week. Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station, in collaboration with the Gongwer News Service. Mishmash is hosted and produced by me, Shayna Roth, and Gongwer's Zach Gorchow and Alethea Kasbin.
Additional production and editing by Hearns Laguerre Jr., mixing, mastering, and music by Sam Bobian.
Our digital team is Dave Kim, Sophia Joswiak, and Jenny Sherman. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. As always, if you listen to this podcast and want to support it, you can do so by leaving us a review or comment wherever you listen. You can subscribe or follow us on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, basically wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell your friends about how much you've learned from Mishmash and send them a link. Learn more about Gongwer News Service at gongwer.com.
Remember, we're produced by a public radio station, which means we are listener supported. So if you really, really like this podcast, you can support WDET by going to wdet.org/give. We'll talk to you next week.